This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 63 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me, as he always is Mike Morrison. Today, we'll be discussing the definition of life inside the Star Trek universe. Mike, how are you today?
I'm doing very well, Zachary. I believe that there is a 2,228.7-to-1 chance that you and I will have something to say about life in the Star Trek universe today.
Do you think there's a chance of discovering a new life form while we're doing the podcast today?
It's entirely possible.
What if it doesn't meet our definition of life? Would we recognize it as life?
I think we would have to sit back, quantify. It's got to meet the criteria. I mean, it has to meet Dr. Crusher's criteria in order for it to be life. Otherwise, we just label it unknown specimen, unknown sample, put it in a jar, set it on the shelf.
I don't know about you, but I think Dr. Crusher gives the absolute worst definition of life imaginable. I mean, it's the most vague, imprecise, jumbled together definition I've ever seen. Should we read it?
We should read it.
Okay, so according to Dr. Crusher, the definition of life is, she says, quote, "The broadest scientific definition might be that life is what enables plants and animals to consume food, derive energy from it, grow, adapt themselves to their surroundings, and reproduce." Half the aliens in Star Trek don't meet those criteria.
But she does kind of cover it all. It's just a jumbled mess.
Well, as I was thinking about how we would approach this question of the definition of life, it occurred to me that a great many people out there, I think, don't realize the scope of different kinds of definitions there really are. We tend to think of definitions, you look in the dictionary, you look up some criteria, and that's your definition, as if the definitions are already spelled out and laid out, and there's only one kind of them, whatever you find in the dictionary. But in reality, there's countless different kinds of definitions, and those definitions are applicable in different contexts and are useful in different ways, some of which are theoretical definitions, some of which are more practical definitions. And I thought we could just run through a list of these different kinds of definitions and see which of these are most fruitful in answering this question about what the definition of life is, in parentheses, inside the Star Trek universe.
Yeah, Zachary, let's do that. But before we do, you know, I consulted Webster's Dictionary on the subject, and I have to say that they're just as mixed up and messed up as Dr. Crusher. In fact, I think they're a little bit more so. They have 20 different definitions laid out. For instance, the quality that distinguishes a vital and functional being from a dead body. That's one. And again, there are 20. Yes, very helpful. 20 different.
Living means not dead.
Living means not dead. So I think they're more mixed up than Dr. Crusher. I will have to say that Beverly definitely simplified things, at least when compared to Webster's Dictionary here in the 21st century.
I think compounding the problem is that presumably there is a sphere, a set of things that properly count as life forms. And the goal of providing a definition of life is to try to encompass all of those things that are genuinely living beings and exclude all of those things that are not genuinely living beings. And part of the problem is that we don't know what life is like in the universe, right? So as we're trying to sort of circle in and hone in on a definition of life, all we have is the life that we've encountered to go on. So as we try to spell out the the criteria that define the types of living beings that we're familiar with, we hope that we can be broad enough to encompass other life forms that we encounter either on our own planet or elsewhere in the universe, but not so broad as to encompass things that aren't genuinely living life forms. And there are these beings that are on the fringes, right? In Star Trek, we get a whole host of these. We get energy beings, and we get non-corporeal beings, and we get gaseous beings, and we get macroviruses and pick
electromagnetic. There's a whole host of
exactly
types of life
so you want a definition that's broad enough to encompass those all of those beings, whatever genuinely count as life forms, but exclude things that aren't genuinely living. And unfortunately, we're in a position of ignorance. We don't really know what that set is, so we're trying to circle in on the definition when we don't know what the proper objects of that definition should be.
Well, Zachary, should we dive into some of the different kinds of definitions when we're talking about life forms? I agree with Data. I love scanning for life forms, but it's difficult to scan for life forms if we don't have definitions for what those life forms are, what life is. So how can we scan if we don't know? So I think we really have to define our terms here for what qualifies as life.
Well, we'll just go through a list of different kinds of definitions, and we'll see which of these are most applicable to identifying genuine life forms and excluding things that aren't genuine life forms, and which of these are most relevant to what's going on inside the Star Trek universe. The simplest, and I think probably the most basic type of definition, is what's called an ostensive definition. Literally just pointing to something and saying, when I say life, I mean that. Kind of like Captain Picard pointing to Data and saying, I don't know what life is, but there it sits.
There it sits, yes.
So that's an ostensive definition. If you can point to it and go, when I say life, I mean that. When I point to a caterpillar, or I point to a human being, or I point to a Vulcan, right? That's an ostensive definition. When I say life, I mean that kind of being. Now, you can see that that's not terribly helpful, right? Because it doesn't do anything to establish what the criteria are, what properties distinguish that being from other kinds of beings. So that might be accurate. You could point to a genuine life form and say, when I say life, I mean one of those, but it doesn't do anything to spell the different categories of life, the different subspecies of life. So it's not a very helpful type of definition, although it can be surprisingly accurate. If you point to a life form and go, that's life right there, I know it when I see it. That's a way of identifying life. I just don't think it's the most helpful, but there it sits. That's my example of an ostensive definition. Mm. So another kind of definition is what's called a stipulative definition. And like you might gather from the name, a stipulative definition is a definition that you postulate for the purpose of a particular discussion. So like if we were having this theoretical discussion, much like we're doing here on Metatrex about the definition of life, we could say, you know, Mike, for the purpose of this discussion, let's just agree that life is going to be considered something that has DNA. Right, that would be a stipulative definition. Mm-hmm. For the purpose of this discussion, let's just agree that this counts as life and this doesn't count as life. And you can see that, again, that's not terribly helpful because you're automatically excluding things that don't meet the criteria of the stipulation. So it's not terribly open to new kinds of evidence. It's not open to encountering different kinds of beings that may or may not count as life. You know, you're just agreeing that for the purpose of this discussion, let's just limit the field of inquiry to something that we know about, and let's stipulate that we mean this.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I think that would oftentimes apply to a gaseous life form that we see many times inside Star Trek. I mean, are we able to distinguish DNA in those types of life forms? I think by and large, the answer would probably be no, not really. And that may not necessarily be the case, but I think oftentimes I don't think we are going to attribute DNA to a gaseous life form. And yet we have multiple examples in just about every iteration of Star Trek of a gaseous sentient life form.
Yeah, but you know, you could imagine if you're like a DNA researcher, you could say, you know, for the purpose of the discussion or for the purpose of this research paper, let's just say that the definition of life is blah, 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 something involving DNA, and we'll just exclude everything else for the purpose of this discussion. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not going to be terribly helpful for fleshing out the sort of true definition of the term, right? What properly does count as a a member of a certain class of objects as of living beings and what doesn't count. But it can be helpful for moving a discussion forward. Like if you know you're not going to be interested in certain types of cases or certain types of life forms, you can just say, for the purpose of this discussion, life just means this, and let's have our discussion based on that. So it can be helpful for moving a dialogue forward in a certain field, but not too helpful for fleshing out the true definition of a term, I would say. So moving on, another type of definition is what's called a precising definition. And again, like the name indicates, a precising definition is used to add precision or clarify a vague or an ambiguous term. I think if you want to understand what this means, a simple example would be something like the word big, right? That's vague. Is something big or something not big? Mm-hmm. In fact, you could apply this to the Star Trek universe, right? You could say, is that Klingon ship big or is that Klingon ship not big? Well, you could say, well, by big, I mean at least 400 meters long. Then you can go, okay, well, that's a lot more precise than just saying big. So you've just given the word big a definition. By big, I mean something a bit more precise, quantitative, measurable. And then that gives you a more accurate, more precise definition. And unfortunately, our language is littered with vague and ambiguous terms. And maybe life is one of these terms. Maybe life is just a vague term where it's not clear that, you know, what exactly we mean by it. And so we have to come along and say, well, by life, I mean something that has this criterion or something that has these properties or something that has DNA or something that is sentient or something that reproduces. And this is kind of what Dr. Crusher is doing.
Yes.
She's kind of saying, you know, by life, I mean something a bit more precise, a bit more measurable, a bit more quantifiable. And I do think any good definition, when you have a potentially ambiguous term or a vague term like life, where it's not clear what it means, not clear what it applies to, you want a definition that gives you more precision than that potentially vague term.
Indeed. And oftentimes those vague terms are relative to both the person who is sharing the term as well as the person who, because big obviously is going to mean something different to everybody.
This is one of my problems with the way that these terms are handled inside the Star Trek universe. As rich as Star Trek is in terms of considering philosophical issues and philosophical concepts, oftentimes Star Trek, for the purpose of moving the story forward, right? I mean, Star Trek is still a form of drama too, right? So it's not all about doing philosophy. But oftentimes when philosophical concepts are invoked inside the Star Trek universe, they're invoked in such an abstract, vague, broad way where you need to kind of dive in and go, well, what exactly do you mean by that? Mm-hmm. What do you mean by sentience? What do you mean by life? What do you mean by intelligence? What do you mean by big Klingon ships, right? You have to dive in and make distinctions, and that's where the real philosophy comes in. And as rich as Star Trek is in terms of raising philosophical issues, the real philosophical work, I think, comes in and starting to split hairs and make distinctions and ask those precising questions. So the next type of definition, and I think the one that we're probably most interested in when we're talking about the definition of life for the purpose of this discussion, is a theoretical definition. When we're asking what is life inside the Star Trek universe or here on our own planet, when scientists ask, what's the definition of life? How can we distinguish life forms from non-life forms? What they're really looking for are a set of criteria, right? What are the theoretical constructs that make up this definition of life? And usually that involves diving down and invoking invoking other theoretical concepts, right? Things like DNA, things like reproductive processes, things like digestive processes, all these terms and theories and this web of things we think we understand about life constitute our theoretical definition of life. And we're trying to kind of take this vague term, the definition of life, and define it in terms of all these other theoretical constructs. I think a simple example might be something like, what's the definition of matter? We can go, well, you know, one theory of matter is that matter is made of atoms, which are made of particles, which are made of quarks, which are made of whatever, right? Mm-hmm. You're kind of drilling down and providing a theoretical model of what counts as matter. And when you do that with life, you could say, okay, what constitutes life? Well, life is, you know, has certain kinds of processes. They involve things like cells and DNA and certain kinds of processes. And you're giving a theoretical construct of what counts as life. And I think that's probably what we're most interested in scientifically and maybe philosophically. But we should say, too, that a theoretical definition is probably the hardest definition to come across, because it not only needs to identify living beings from non-living beings, but you have to give the theoretical underpinnings for what counts as life, right? What are the criteria? How do you recognize it? What what ways can you measure it? Just what other theoretical concepts are combined in what ways to produce this larger concept called life? And so it's probably the most difficult type of definition to construct accurately. It's the most useful, but it's the hardest to come by. So if theoretical definitions are really hard to come by, and it's not easy to spell out the criteria for what counts as a living being, what else can we do? And I think one other approach to definitions is what's called an enumerative definition. An enumerative definition tries to identify or list or count all the different members of the class denoted by a term. So if you take a term like living being, life, you can say, okay, what are we going to do to enumerate, you know, the different things that count as life? Let's go around and start counting up living beings. Okay, Mike, there's one. Zach, there's another one. You know, my cat in the other room, there's number three. You know, the caterpillar outside my window, that's number four. So on and so forth. And just literally enumerating all the different things that count as life. And if you can do that exhaustively, you can say, well, if by life, I mean all of these things, everything in the universe that I could point to, that would be an exhaustive enumerative definition of the category of life. And obviously that's massively impractical, even in the Star Trek universe. Sure. With warp drive, right? You can't really do that. What you can do is give a partial enumerative definition, right? You can say, I'm going to give you a few examples of things that count as life. And even if that's accurate, you know, the hope is that you can start to look at the similarities between those and drill down and see what they all have in common. What's that spark of life? What are the criteria they all share that make them a member of that overall class of objects, living beings? So it's not as rich as a theoretical definition, because you know, just enumerating a bunch of things that count as a member of that class doesn't do anything to itself to identify the criteria that those objects share that makes them all a part of the class of living objects. But it can be a useful first step, right? If you can at least do that, then you can say, okay, here's 50 things that all count as life. Let's look at them and see what properties they share in common, where they differ, and maybe we can get at some essential properties of life by doing that kind of compare and contrast. That approach, this approach of enumerating objects of a class, doesn't itself reveal any of the essential characteristics of those objects, but it can be a good preliminary step to answering that deeper theoretical question we were talking about a minute ago.
And Zachary, it occurs to me as I look over Dr. Crusher's definition of life, it seems like perhaps that's what she's done. She's enumerated and drilled down into some of the things that each life form perhaps that she's encountered does. And she's listing those things out. She's saying, well, it consumes food, it derives energy from it, it grows, it adapts, it reproduces. And so it just occurs to me that this may be at the heart of her definition. And it's just not entirely satisfying.
Well, I think Dr. Crusher is taking that first baby step from enumerating actual objects, right? A strictly speaking, enumerative definition would literally list all of the members of a class, right?
So
if you say living objects, she would say Captain Picard, he's a living being, and Counselor Troi, she's a living being, and Data's cat Spot, he's a living being, or she. which is
she.
It? I can't remember. She's a living being.
And she's and taking that first step.
And that would be an enumerative definition, listing out all the individual members of a class. And this is a very massive class, a class of living beings, right? And you can do it on a smaller scale. You can say, okay, let's enumerate the class of beings on the Enterprise, right? Well, there's 1,000 and some change, right? So you could actually do that. You could list out all 1,000 plus living beings on the Enterprise. And that would be a complete enumerative definition of this class of objects, things that are living on the Enterprise, right? You could do that, but you can't presumably exhaustively list, for practical reasons, every individual living being in the entire universe. That's not practical, right? So I think Dr. Crusher has done, she's not giving an enumerative definition, but she's
taken
beyond
that first step.
She's taken that first step into a deeper dive into trying to list the criteria that distinguish living beings from non-living beings. So she's trying to get at a theoretical definition, but I still feel like she's taking the shotgun approach, just listing a bunch of criteria without any really coherent account of how they all fit together and how they distinguish living beings from non-living beings.
Yes, and at least in the Star Trek universe, and we can use Data as an example, Data certainly doesn't consume food. He does grow, he does adapt, but not in a physical sense. He physically remains the same. And he was certainly able to reproduce, but not in the sense that you and I would probably consider reproduction. Even if we take Dr. Crusher's definition and we apply it, and that might be a fun thing to do as we start looking at some of these life forms inside the Star Trek universe, if we start applying this, we really start to poke some holes into Dr. Crusher's definition here.
Well, I think it's not helpful to look at the obvious cases, right? If you're asking, what's the definition of life? And you go, I don't know, let's go look at a bunch of humans and see whether they're alive, right? Like, well, that's not helpful. We already know that they're alive, right? What's helpful is examining the fringe cases or the boundary cases. Data, he shares some of those properties, but not other of those right. properties. You know, other life forms that are encountered, like I'm thinking of something like non-corporeal or energy-based or not solid, like the Calamarain or something like that, right? They share some of those properties, but maybe not all of those list of properties that Dr. Crusher enumerates. So what do you do about that? You can either expand your definition or you can restrict your definition and say, well, no, they don't meet this definition of life. By life, we mean something a bit more restrictive. And those other kinds of things are interesting. They share some properties of life, but they're not life per se. And we face this question here on our own planet, right? We have viruses, for example. And viruses share some properties of living beings, but not other properties of living Correct. Beings. So there's a genuine theoretical question. Do viruses count as a living being? Yes, they can reproduce. They don't consume food, right? So viruses, I think it's a genuine question. Are viruses living or not? Well, you can either expand your definition and go, well, yeah, you know, we need to have a broader definition that includes these fringe cases like viruses and like the Calamarain, or we can restrict our definition and say, no, by life, we mean something that has this set of criteria. And there are other kinds of beings that are interesting. They have interesting behaviors, interesting properties, but they're not strictly speaking life. And it's an interesting theoretical question. Do you, when you encounter something that's a fringe case, a borderline case, do you expand your definition or do you restrict your definition at that point? And this happened recently within the last few years. I'm thinking of the definition of a planet here in our solar system, right? Mm-hmm. Originally, the definition of planet was, well, these massive things that circle this orbit the sun and they have seem to be of a certain size and whatnot. Then we started encountering a bunch of other objects that shared some properties of planets, but didn't have other properties of planets. They're smaller. They're farther out in the solar system. They're in the Oort cloud. They had eccentric orbits and they hadn't cleared their orbits of stray debris. And so they were planet-like, but they weren't as planet-like as Jupiter or Saturn mm-hmm. or Earth, right? So what do? Do you broaden the definition of planet to encompass all several hundred or several thousand of these new objects that are being discovered? Or do you restrict the definition of planet and exclude those things and just define it as a new class? And in here in the last few years, that's what happened with the definition of the planet, right? The definition of planet got restricted to exclude some of these other objects. And unfortunately, Pluto seemed Poor more like Pluto. Those other objects. Yes, then it seemed like you know the other planets. Mm-hmm. So they had to say, you know, we're going to draw a line somewhere because there's a genuine line drawing problem. We're going to try to list some criteria, and one of the criteria they came up with was a planet has to be massive enough to clear its orbit of debris. And Jupiter's done that, Saturn's done that, Earth has done that more or less, even though we have a moon. And so, you know, when you say, okay, when they try to list out the criteria of what counts as a planet, you can go, okay, well, Pluto seems more like these other things than like a genuine planet. And it's a bit arbitrary. It's a bit of a line drawing problem. It's not a clear cut case, but it was a genuine scientific choice. Do you expand the definition of planet and hence, you know, result in 100 or 200 or 1,000 planets, or do you restrict the definition of planet to keep the number small and to have sort of clearer demarcation between these different, you know, categories of objects. So, you know, apply that to the definition of life. Well, life is, you know, it consumes food and reproduces and all these things that Dr. Crusher mentions. Mm-hmm. What happens when you encounter the Calamarain or Data? You go, well, Data meets some of those criteria. The Calamarain meets some other of those criteria. Do we broaden the definition of life to make this, you know, overarching but a little vague of a concept to be inclusive? Or do we restrict the definition of life to be more precise, more accurate, and hence exclude those fringe cases? And I think it's just not obvious at all. And scientists have to collectively decide how to define their terms. But it's not arbitrary. I think the goal is really to try to define criteria that genuinely do distinguish different types of beings from other types of beings and try to be as precise and accurate as possible. So it's not arbitrary. And I think, you know, the scientists that, you know, banished Pluto from being a planet get a bit of bad press, you know, because the press describes it as being arbitrary. Like, they redefined the definition of planet. Now Pluto's not a planet anymore, and everyone's pissed off about mm-hmm. it. And that's not what happened at all. There was a genuine distinction between these tiny little Kuiper Belt objects and massive planets like Pluto. Those aren't the same kind of objects, right? So they needed some way of distinguishing them from each other. And there are these going to be these fringe cases in the middle where it's not obvious at all what to do with it. And in this case, they just had to kind of make a stipulative definition. Like, by planet, we mean something that has these criteria. And that's a good example of a stipulative definition, actually. They said, you know, we're going to stipulate that a planet means this. Right. And we're going to draw a somewhat arbitrary line, and anything that doesn't meet those criteria is not a planet. But that doesn't make them any less of a border case or a fringe case. So if we kind of go down the list here, we've covered theoretical definitions, which are the most helpful, but also the hardest to come by, the hardest to get accurate. We covered enumerative definitions, where the goal is to literally enumerate every single individual member of an entire class of objects, which for obvious reasons is not practical when you're talking about life forms in the universe. You can't list out every single life form in the universe, individual life, not even types of life forms. A slightly more practical thing to do is to try to list all the different subclasses that fall under the class that you're trying to define. So I'm trying to give a Star Trek example of this. So suppose you were trying to define the class of humanoids, everything that counts as a member of the class of humanoids. Mm-hmm. You could do this by defining subclasses. Well, by humanoid, I mean things like humans, and that's a subclass, right? There's individual members inside the class of humans, but humans is a subclass of humanoid. Vulcans, that's another subclass of humanoid, right? And then there are individual members of the class of Vulcans, Spock and T'Pol and the other Vulcans we see in Star Trek. But Vulcans is a subclass of humanoids. So you have a better chance of exhausting all of the subclasses of a class that you're trying to define than of exhausting all the individual members of that larger class. Sure. Like, I can't list all the humans and all the Vulcans and all the Romulans and all the Klingons, but I can define their categories. I can say by humanoid, I mean Vulcans, Romulans, Ferengi, Klingons, and if I can do that exhaustively, I've at least exhausted the sphere of members of that larger class of humanoids.
Sure. And you have to define those terms. I mean, you have to determine, if to use your example, you know, what is the defining characteristics of a humanoid? And sometimes you can do that by looking at those subclasses and saying, okay, what do all of these, you know, what do Ferengi and Vulcans and Cardassians and humans and Bolians, what do they all have in common? It could be something in terms of, you know, their physical appearance, because at least in all of these cases, you know, they're typically, you know, biped creatures. They have, you know, two arms, two legs. They have a head. It may be partially defined by their organ structure, not necessarily where those organs are, but we know that they have a circulatory system and a respiratory system and a nervous system and so on and so forth. So I think you have to start defining terms in order to really distinguish these subclasses and how they fit in the overall definition.
Well, again, I think a definition by subclass is not a theoretical definition, right? So you don't really have to have a deep understanding of the distinguishing characteristics that define these individual subclasses in order to know that they're distinct classes, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I could say, what counts as a Federation starship? I can go, well, Sovereign class starships, Galaxy class starships, Constitution class starships. I don't have to know very much about those in order to distinguish them as classes, right? I know that they're different, but I haven't told you anything at all about how they're different. But I can give a complete definition by subclass by listing all of classes of starship, but without telling you anything theoretical or any actual criteria that distinguish them from each other, right?
Right.
So again, this is, you know, it's very easy to confuse this with a theoretical definition. This could be a first step in leading to a theoretical definition. You can go, mm-hmm. okay, well, now that we know all the subclasses, what do they have in common? And I think the starship analogy is actually a good one. You can go, well, let's look at all the Federation starships, all the classes of starships. And I love that we use the word class of starship, right? This is literally what we're talking about, a class of starship, right? The Galaxy class starship versus the Intrepid class starship versus the Constitution class starship. Yeah, we can list all those different classes, and in doing so, we will exhaustively list the class of everything that counts as a Federation starship. Mm-hmm. But from there, we can drill down and maybe get at a more theoretical definition. What do those ships all have in common? Is it the color scheme? Is it a certain hull shape? Is it a certain size? Is it a matter of whose flag it's carrying, right? Whatever those criteria are, you can drill down and go, well, do they all share some property in common that leads them to be part of this bigger class? And I think with starships, it's not easy to know how to do that, right? Were they all christened by a bottle of Chateau Picard? Is that how it works?
Yeah, once upon a time, we could simply look at, they all had a saucer section, a secondary hull, and a couple of nacelles, and they broaden that out, and okay, now we have four nacelles, and then we have the Defiant that doesn't really have a distinguished saucer section. We've got other classes of ships within Starfleet that doesn't meet those criteria. The Delta Flyer is another example, doesn't really meet the criteria.
I'm trying to think, how would an exobiologist inside the Star Trek universe answer this question of the definition of life? Assuming that they don't know enough about life to give a truly exhaustive theoretical, definition that's knocked down, that absolutely does the trick, where they've answered the fundamental question of life. I think they might start by going, well, life is a pretty big question, so we need to drill down. We've got different types of beings. We've got humanoids, we've got insectoids, we've got energy beings like Q, we've got whatever. And what they would do, though, I think they would start giving subclasses. Well, life is too broad of a question, but we can start drilling down a little bit. What do you mean by life? I mean, well, are we talking humanoid life? Are we talking insectoid life? Are we talking aquatic life? What are we talking here? And then from there, you can go, okay, humanoid life, that's what we're talking about. Well, are we talking about Vulcan humanoid life? Are we talking about Klingon humanoid life? They would essentially, I think, give a progressively more detailed and more restrictive taxonomy of the different categories of life. And that's how an exobiologist, I think, would do it. They would essentially be a galactic taxonomist. Because this is essentially what we do with life on our own planet. We say, life on Earth, well, what do you mean? Are we talking insects? Are we talking mammals? Are we talking birds? Are we talking dinosaurs? Are we talking microbial life? Are we talking macroscopic or microscopic, everything in between? What are we talking about, right? You would start by defining different subclasses that have progressively smaller subclasses that have progressively smaller subclasses. And in doing so, the goal is to exhaust all the different classes and subclasses that count as life. So a couple of other kinds of definitions that I think aren't terribly helpful for getting at the definition of life are synonymous definitions and etymological definitions. A synonymous definition is, just like the name indicates, you define a term by giving a one-to-one synonymous term, mm-hmm. Which can be helpful for learning a language, right? And this is essentially what you do when you're learning a language. Like, give me a Klingon word, Mike. Do you know a Klingon word?
Kapla.
So let's take the word kapla in Klingon. If you were to give a definition of kapla in English, you would say kapla means fill in the blank. And fill in the blank, we'd probably say something like success. Kapla, success, right? So that is a synonymous definition. Kapla is success. And you can do this kind of one-to-one language translation. And you can do that within a language. You can say cold means chilly, right? Something like that. Those are roughly synonymous words, and you can say cold means chilly or kapla means success. And I think that that's helpful, because if you're learning a language, it's very helpful, but it's not terribly helpful in getting at the theoretical underpinnings, right? What do cold and chilly have in common that makes them the same thing? What do kapla and success have in common that makes them mean the same thing? What does life and can we do this for life? Is there a single kind of term that also means life or living? You can do it, but you can do it by its opposite, right? You can say life means, in fact, we joked about this at the beginning of the show. Living means not dead. Right. That's roughly a type of synonym. It's a definition by antonym or the opposite term. You can see that's not really enlightening in terms of the definition of life or what essential properties that being has. So it's useful for learning a language, but not terribly helpful for doing science.
Well, in the example that you use, Zachary, kapla, and we were talking in the Turbolift about, what that word means. And the problem is, it's easy to conflate that word because it's used in so many different ways in the Star Trek universe. It may roughly define into the English language or translate in the English language as success, but it's used as a greeting. So we can easily conflate hello or goodbye with success, good hunting, just all of the different ways in which kapla is used in the Star Trek universe, it's just, it seems to me that it would be very easy to conflate. And I think that could be also true when we're trying to define life by using synonymous terms.
So I'm trying to think how we could do this with the definition of life. Is there a synonymous definition for life? And again, this is not going to be terribly helpful in coming up with a theoretical definition, but I think we can do it. So you could say something like, well, if a being is living, it has vitality. Right? Those essentially mean the same things. I mean, it has vitality is by definition something yes. that's living. Those are roughly synonymous.
Yes.
So, and because they're synonymous, one doesn't shed any more light on the other, right? They can have different shades of meaning, different connotations, different emotional connotations. One's a bit more colorful. One's a bit more poetic. But strictly speaking, denotatively, they say the same exact thing. So because of that, they don't elucidate the essential properties of each other. So it's not helpful for our purpose, which our purpose is to drill down and try to get at the essential characteristics of life. And just by saying that something is living is something that is vital doesn't quite cut it.
Right.
So much for synonymous definitions. Another type of definition that I think is less than helpful is an etymological definition. And etymology, of course, is the study of word origins mm-hmm. and how words came to have their meaning based on their antecedents in previous languages and such. So you could say, well, what's the definition of, in fact, the word we just used, vital, right? What's the definition of vital? We can go, well, that comes from the Latin word vita, which means life, right? That's not helpful in understanding the theoretical definition of life, but it can be helpful for understanding how our language came to be the way it is, you know, what we mean, what shades of meaning are inherited from ancient languages. But I don't think it's very helpful for getting at a theoretical discussion, but it's very interesting for studying languages. So that's another type of definition that's not terribly helpful. Like, what's the etymology of kapla? I would love to do some Klingon etymology and find out the historical ancient Klingon antecedent to the word kapla.
And again, the problem is, I think over time, you coined the phrase very well. You talked about the shades of meaning. Those shades of meaning oftentimes are just simply lost. And again, words become conflated over time. And, you know, in our own language, we have words that we use today that don't have anything near the same meaning that it did, say, 50 years ago. And so those shades of meaning get lost. And so it's, you know, it's just not helpful at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's helpful for studying language, it's helpful for writing poetry, it's helpful for understanding, you know, if you're reading ancient texts, it's very important, but it's not revealing of the essential properties. Because when we're asking the definition of life, we don't care about the poetry of life, right? We care about what real objects are there out in the universe that properly count as life in reality, mm-hmm. right? So the shades of meaning just don't matter for the purpose of our discussion. But it's interesting. I don't want to say poetry doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter when you're trying to ask the theoretical question of the definition of life. So etymological definitions are not going to be very helpful. So there are two more types of definitions that I want to talk about because I think these are helpful. One is an operational definition. And an operational definition basically tries to define a term or define a property by something we can manipulate, hence the name operational definition. Some sort of activity, some sort of theoretical practice, some sort of measurement that helps us distinguish something from something else. Like a simple example here from the real world, like if you wanted to say, let's talk about the definition of the flow of electrons, electric current through a circuit, mm-hmm. right? That's something simple. Most people know something about that, right? We all know about electricity and wires and whatnot, right?
We're going to tap into our Tandy days, aren't we?
We are. We're taking it back to Radio Shack.
For our listeners who may not know, it's something that you and I, Zachary, have in common. We both worked for Radio Shack for a while.
It feels like another lifetime ago, but oddly enough, working at Radio Shack really shaped all the rest of my work experience and shaped my personal and professional growth in ways that I could only hope to enumerate.
So let's talk about circuits.
Yeah, so getting back to circuits, like if you were going to try to define electric current, the flow of electrons through a circuit, you can give a theoretical discussion of that. You can talk about atoms and how some atoms have electrons that aren't bound to their nucleus very well, and so it doesn't take very much force to knock them free and begin to allow electrons to flow through a circuit. That's a theoretical definition, right? Defining electric current in terms of numbers and equations and theoretical constructs and and whatnot, things you learn about in electronics 101. But you can give an operational definition of the flow of electrons. You can say, well, current is flowing through the circuit. If you hook an ammeter, a current meter, in line with the circuit, and then the needle moves. If that's happening, there's current flowing in the circuit. That's an operational definition of current flow, something you can measure, something you can quantify. If you follow a certain procedure, something will happen, and that will tell you, is there current flowing or not? And that's it can identify the very same phenomenon, right? If you identify current that way versus identifying current in a theoretical way, they're going to pick out and point to the same phenomenon, right? They're both going to point to current flowing through wires. They're just going to get at it very different ways. And I think in Star Trek, you can do this with the definition of life. You can say, well, how do you distinguish between something living and something non-living? Well, if you take your tricorder and you open it up and you set it to a certain setting and you scan for life forms, life forms, I love scanning for life forms. Right? If you do that and you get a reading, you can go, oh, well, there must be life there, right? Because I got a reading on my tricorder. That's an operational definition of life. Life is things that make my tricorder go ding.
Mm-hmm.
Right, or something to that effect, to characterize it a little bit. But that you can give an operational definition of life. You can go, well, what's the definition of a microbe? Well, if you look in your microscope and you see a certain phenomenon and blah 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 blah, then you have a microbe, right? And you can do this when you're doing science. Again, the goal though is to get at a deeper, more theoretical understanding. That can be helpful for identifying the phenomenon. It's definitely helpful when you're actually doing hands-on practical science, because you do need to distinguish whether or not a certain phenomenon is present using the instruments that you have. But the goal is to kind of get even deeper than that operational definition and try to get at the theoretical underpinnings for the definition. So that was my Radio Shack example. if you can detect current with your ammeter, you can detect life forms with your tricorder.
And again, I think there's some operational aspects to Beverly Crusher's definition. You know, she's talking about consuming food. So she's saying, okay, when I extend sustenance to it, it consumes it. And it, when I stimulate it, it adapts.
Yeah, there's very much a hands-on, empirical researcher kind of shade to the definitions that Dr. Crusher gives. Mm-hmm. So that's an operational definition. I think anyone who does hands-on practical science will tend to think in terms of operational definitions.
And I think that was Dr. Mora's experience as he was dealing with Odo. You know, it was very empirical. It was very hands-on. And honestly, that seems to be how he came to the conclusion that Odo wasn't an unknown sample, but rather a life form.
Yeah, I think this is absolutely right. I'm putting myself in Dr. Mora's mind here. He's going, okay, I've got this puddle of goo inside my petri dish, inside my jello mold. And when I take my electrodes and I shove the electrodes into it, it moves or it shapeshifts or it, gives me a pat on the back or whatever Odo did. Right? In his mind, he's going, okay, it must be alive because when I apply a certain test procedure to it, I get a certain result and I only get those kinds of results with living beings. So it must be alive, right? And that's a very operational way of defining whether or not you've got a life form. So the last type of definition that I want to talk about is a bit of a mouthful. It's called definition by genus and species, or definition by genus and difference. And the way it works is basically you define something in terms of the larger class that it's a part of, but then distinguish a criterion that makes it different. So earlier we were talking about humanoids. So suppose you wanted to define what a Vulcan is. What does it mean for something to be a Vulcan? You can say, well, a Vulcan means, and you say, well, it's a member of the class of humanoids, but it's a different kind of humanoid. These are logical humanoids, right? So you could say Vulcan means a logical humanoid, and the humanoid is the larger class that it's a part of, and a Vulcan is a genus or a kind or a subspecies of that larger class, and it's distinguished by this property of being logical. So you can make, So you can drill down into subspecies by saying, well, here's a new subspecies and here's what makes that subspecies different. It seems to have a different property. So so I'm trying to think of an example, a goofy example from Star Trek. I'm thinking of the episode Macrocosm from Voyager.
Okay.
You know, remember that episode? We get the big bugs, yeah. the large germs, the macroscopic the viruses,
macrovirus,
right?
Yeah.
Exactly. So what is a macrovirus? You can go, well, a macrovirus is a very big, and that's the distinguishing characteristic, large or you know, usual larger than average size macro. Or more massive macro, right? Macro virus. So a macro virus is still a virus. It's still in the larger category of viruses, but it's a large virus. So it has a different property that distinguishes it from the rest of the viruses that we know. And that can be, again, useful for defining subspecies, because earlier we were asking the question, well, how do you distinguish subspecies from each other? You know, if you can enumerate the different subclasses of a certain class that you're trying to define, the burden is then to try to distinguish what are the characteristics that really do define a unique subclass. And if you can do that, you can at least give a better taxonomy of the different subspecies that you have within a class. But again, that's still like a first baby step towards understanding the more theoretical definition.
Yeah, because oftentimes it's not a single, like in your example with Vulcan, they're logical humanoids. Well, there's more to it than that. And so...
Logical pointy-eared humanoids.
Logical pointy-eared.
Yeah, well, we could do this. Let's do a few, right? Okay, this is fun. Let's do it. What defines a Vulcan? Vulcan is a logical pointy-eared, what else, humanoid?
Logical pointy ear.
Very strong.
Yeah, they're very strong.
Usually.
Long life.
Long lived.
Yeah.
So far we've got Vulcans are logical, pointy eared, very strong, long lived humanoids. Mm-hmm. Now, again, this does not give you a definition of humanoid, right? This doesn't give you even a great definition of Vulcan. But what it does do, I think, if you can do that, you've still learned something. I guess that's my point. You haven't exhaustively defined humanoids. You haven't exhaustively defined Vulcans. But you have learned something, and you have better distinguished Vulcans from non-Vulcans.
Yeah. Green-blooded.
Green-blooded? That's a great one. How did we forget that one?
Can't forget that they're green-blooded. And we can do this.
Dr. McCoy would say, you know, mind-bogglingly irritating.
Emotionless well. Hobgoblin. Right. And we can do this. We can do this with Boleans. We can, you know, they're blue and so on and so forth. And Ferengi have the big, large lobes, large ears, and they're typically short. They have large dual-lobe craniums and so on and so forth.
I guess my point in talking about this type of definition by genus and species, is that oftentimes when you're asking the question of the definition of life, it's like all or nothing. Do you know the definition of life or do you not know the definition of life? And in reality, it's just a lot more complicated than that, right? We can't maybe give a knockdown 100%, you know, totally accurate theoretical definition of life that correctly includes all the genuinely living beings and correctly excludes all the non-living beings with all of the theoretical underpinnings and figuring out how carbon-based life forms relate to silicon-based life forms and, you know, all the theoretical stuff that would go into an exhaustive definition of life. But what we can do is drill down. Like, we can say, okay, let's ignore this larger question of life for the moment because it's really hard, and let's see what we do know. Well, we know that humanoids are different from aquatic beings, which are different from macroviruses, right? And we can start making categories. And then inside those categories, we can go, well, what subcategories exist? What other types of beings mm-hmm. are there? Can we make even more fine-grained distinctions? Can we start listing out some of the properties? And I guess my point is just that if you can do that even a little bit, you've learned something. So you've partially addressed the question of life without exhaustively giving a complete definition of life.
Right. Right.
And that's progress.
Well, Zachary, now that we have in many ways almost exhaustively given some definitions, some criteria for life forms, and talked about some of the terminology that we use when we are defining life, let's have a little bit of fun. Let's talk about some of the fringe life forms. We don't want to deal with the obvious ones. So we've talked about Boleans and Vulcans and Romulans and so on and so forth.
Well, we know they're living.
Let's
right?
talk about some of the fringe life forms in Star Trek, because there are a lot of unique life forms that our intrepid crews encounter throughout the galaxy.
So one of the first ones that came to mind when I was first starting to think about interesting life forms in Star Trek was the Horta.
Yeah, the Horta is a very interesting life form. When we encounter the Horta, I don't think there was ever any question that it was a life form. You know, as they piece this puzzle together, they notice that it seems to want to defend itself. It cuts through rock, it moves, it consumes. But the unique thing about the Horta is that it is a silicon-based life form. And two times in Star Trek, we discuss the fact that silicon-based life forms are life forms that are not able to evolve on M-class planets with O2-based atmosphere. And we discover that in Devil in the Dark, which is our episode here with the Horta. And we also talk about it in the episode of Enterprise, Observer Effect. And there are actually several times in the Star Trek universe that we encounter silicon-based life forms. The Horta is not unique in that sense. In fact, another time in Star Trek, the original series, we encounter a silicon-based life form in the form of Yarnak in the episode Savage Curtains. So Yarnak, as opposed to the Horta, was a little more humanoid. It was biped. It had arms, it had legs, it had a head, unlike the Horta that was, you know, very much kind of like a rock that moved through rock.
I think silicon-based life forms in Star Trek are interesting because as long as we've had biochemistry here in the real world, there's been talk of silicon-based life forms because as long as we've known about the biochemistry of life, the fact that life requires encoding in some complex molecules, mm-hmm. and here on Earth it happens in the form of DNA, if there are other types of molecules that can be formed in complex structures because their atoms bond easily in various ways, like silicon, I think. And I'm a little outside my element here because I'm not a chemist, right? So don't criticize me for not knowing my chemistry. It's been a long time. But as I understand it, silicon is similar to carbon insofar as carbon forms these complex molecules fairly easily, and so does silicon. So it should be possible to have some sort of silicon-based life form. Insofar as you can encode bioinformation in the form of DNA here on Earth, if you can form similar complex molecules that can do things like replicate in some sort of other biochemistry like silicon, then theoretically you should be able to have life made out of silicon compounds versus made of carbon compounds like happens here in the real world.
And the thing that I love about Star Trek is that it gives form to the theory. Unfortunately, virtually every time they encounter a silicon-based life form, it has violent tendencies of one sort or another, which was the case with our Horta. In fact, it came to the point in which Captain Kirk ordered a shoot to kill on this very unique, one-of-a-kind life form. And, you know, much to Spock's chagrin, he was very much wanting to capture it. He was, you know, he's a scientist. He's wanting to preserve life. Captain Kirk says, I'm not going to lose another man. You know, we're going to shoot to kill. And so we know, at least in the case of the Horta, that its actions seemed violent. But at the end of the episode, we discover that no. Its actions were very much in the line of self-defense. I'm very much reacting like an animal would in the wild, a bear, for instance, protecting its cubs.
I think the Horta really raises the issue of the importance of these different kinds of definitions, because if you go down this list of a couple of these kinds of definitions and apply it to the Horta, I think you get kind of different results. Like if you say, let's start with theoretical definitions. We seem to know that life requires complex molecules, and complex molecules can be carbon-based, but they could also be silicon-based. So sure, according to a theoretical definition of life, theoretically, you should be able to have a silicon-based life form. So no problem with the Horta, right? But if you were starting from a more practical standpoint, say like from an operational standpoint or from a definition based on categories and subcategories based on your previous experience, you might exclude something like the Horta from your past experience, right? You could say, well, let's look at all the types of life we know. We know aquatic life forms, we know humanoids, we know insectoids, and we know cats named Spot, and all of them seem to be based on DNA, right? We have, yes, we can distinguish them with a bunch of categories, but what do they all have in common? They all seem to have this common biochemistry. Even alien humanoids have DNA, right? We hear about this all over the place inside the Star Trek universe. So if you encounter something that doesn't have DNA all of a sudden, then you can go, well, wait a minute. It doesn't look like it has much in common with everything else that we recognize as alive. So should we include it in the class of life forms, or is it a genuinely different kind of thing? But what you've described when Captain Kirk encounters the Horta, you're describing something a bit more operational, right? When I invade its home, it reacts violently. Mm-hmm. When I poke and prod it in certain ways, it reacts a lot like life forms. And that's a much more operational definition of life. Well, if you interact with it in a stimulus response kind of way, and you get in certain responses based on certain kinds of stimuli, then it has just as much of a claim to being a life form as any carbon-based life form that has those responses.
Yeah, because the interesting thing, when Spock mind melds with the Horta, you know, the thing that the Horta kept saying over and over again was pain, pain, pain. Well, in reality, they had injured the Horta with phaser fire. And, you know, obviously it was responding to that pain. It was stimulated and it responded.
Is this a new kind of definition? Definition by mind meld?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, it's funny because you were talking about, you know, an exobiologist who only has experience with carbon-based life forms. So I think that's very interesting because, and I'm going to flip this around a little bit, because one of the other silicon-based life forms that we encounter in the Star Trek universe is the microbrain from Valera 3 in the TNG episode Home Soil. And so the microbrain, once it figured out a way to communicate with Captain Picard, with the Enterprise, it referred to humans as ugly bags of mostly water. And it seems to me that that would be an insult, but in reality, Data says, no, that's actually a pretty accurate picture of humanity. So it's not really looking at these human beings necessarily. I think it's interesting because they looked at human beings much the same way that we would look at a silicon-based life form.
I love that ugly bags of mostly water is the microbrain's first attempt at a theoretical definition of humans.
Well, and that is exactly what's going on in that episode. And I find it fascinating because, again, we have a tendency to label things based on what we can see. Again, we point at things ostensibly, and we're giving these kind of synonymous definitions, and we're groping for something to pin on this to certify it as life. And
I also love that ugly is one of our essential characteristics.
Well, again, I mean, when we look at the Horta, and let's go back to the Horta. You know, when we look at the Horta, I mean, it's this hideous gooey rock. And it, matter of fact, I remember watching this episode. This is one of the episodes that I honestly remember watching in like 1974, 75 in reruns. And I remember thinking that this thing looked like a pile of vomit.
I remember the line, "I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer." That's from that episode.
One of his best.
I thought so.
One of his best. But yes, I mean, it's easy for us to look at something and say, oh, that's ugly, or, oh, that's, you know, and Dr. McCoy, I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer. But what Dr. McCoy failed to realize is that, you know what, doctor, you are a doctor. You are, for all intents and purposes, an exobiologist. You're the most qualified person to determine what's wrong with this thing.
I think what's hard about encountering a totally different kind of life form, like a silicon-based life form, is that there's no easy way to incorporate it into your taxonomy. Like, if you encounter a new kind of humanoid, like when we first see the Ferengi, right, for the first time, you can go, what are Ferengi? Well, they're clearly humanoids, but what kind of humanoid are there? Well, they're large-eared, greedy humanoids, right? So you can do this definition by subclass. You can define them in terms of being members of a larger class that we already fairly well understand. But if you encounter a totally different kind of life form, it's the Horta isn't a subspecies of any other kind of life that we've encountered, if we've only encountered carbon-based life forms before. So what is it? The only larger category that it can be part of is this large category of life that we already admit we don't understand. So you can't give a definition of it in terms of something we do understand, other than operationally, if you poke and prod it and invade its home and you mind meld with it and you get in certain kinds of results. It's like taking your ammeter and playing with the electric circuit. You can go, well, yeah, if I poke and prod it and I do an experiment on it, I get some interesting phenomena, like Dr. Mora, you know, poking Odo with the electrodes, right? You get a result from that that is lifelike, but without the theoretical understanding of what it is, how to incorporate it into your taxonomy, then I think it's overstating it to say you really understand how it fits in relationship to other kinds of life forms that you do understand.
Yeah.
Immediately under the category of life would be something like carbon-based life, right? It's this enormous, broadly encompassing category. And inside of that are humanoids and insectoids and aquatics and spot, right? But if you think immediately below this very broad category of life, there's another large category, you know, still under the broad category of life, but immediately next to carbon-based life forms in your taxonomy would be silicon-based life forms. It's a totally new order of life. And yet, I think if you're encountering that for the first time, you're right to be skeptical. You can go, well, it looks a lot like life. When I poke and prod it, I seem to get certain responses, but it doesn't match up with anything else I recognize as life. So now I have a choice as a scientist. Do we broaden our definition of life and define a totally new order of life? And if you start encountering a bunch of these, like there's not just one example of these horda, if you can find 10 other silicon-based life forms or 10 other species of silicon-based life forms, then it starts to look like that has its own taxonomy, and life, yes, is a very broad category with broader subcategories that you can drill down into. But if you don't find those other examples, if it's just the horda you encounter, you go, well, you know, they look a lot like life, but they also look a lot like rocks. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, is it just a very complex, automated, you know, mechanistic response that you're getting that mimics life in some way, kind of like the mimetic life forms in Voyager?
Yeah, the Silver Blood, I actually was going to bring them up. They were kind of one of the unique fringe life forms I wanted to.
And I think that's really interesting because they truly mimic the properties of life. But I think you might be justified in saying it's just the appearance of life. It's just this biomechanical response in some way we don't understand, but it's not life per se as we know it. It mimics the life. So I think you could say that about the Horda. The Horda, you know, it's got, yes, in universe, of course, we recognize it as life. But if you're encountering it for the first time, you can go, well, it has a lot of life-like properties, but it looks a lot like a rock. Mm-hmm. You could say, well, what about this biomimetic, you know, metallic goo that you get inside Voyager? Well, it looks a lot like life. It, you know, mimics Captain Janeway and mimics Harry Kim and, you know, mimics Voyager itself. But it also looks a lot like Mercury. To me, it looks like the metallic Terminator. You know, is it life or is it just some sort of purely mechanical response that mimics life?
Yeah. In the Voyager episode Demon, the duplicate Harry Kim explains that the Silver Blood was alive, but it didn't experience sentience until after it duplicated Paris and Kim by sampling their DNA. So it required something additional, and that is the sampling of DNA, in order for it to become sentient. But according to duplicate Harry Kim, it was still alive.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, the question of sentience doesn't matter so much because there's lots of non-sentient life forms that are still recognized, sure, in life. So that, I think that's not an essential characteristic of life. But I think, you know, again, if you encounter this Silver Blood for the first time, you can go, well, you know, is it life or is it not? It's lifelike. It's got some lifelike properties, but it doesn't seem to meet other criteria for life. It has a different kind of chemistry than we've seen in previous life forms we've encountered. So I think that when you first encounter it, the position of skepticism is probably the right position. If it doesn't match with any of your previous experience, you can go, well, it's interesting. We don't understand it yet. I'm not immediately prepared to recognize it as life until we understand more about it. And maybe then you can, you know, broaden your definition of life, and maybe not. Maybe it is just some sort of biomechanical response that's not genuinely living per se. I keep saying biomechanical, but I think maybe I mainly mean mechanical, like, yeah, you know, just sort of physical stimulus response, kind of like an automaton, a robot, a machine, mm-hmm, right? Those can be very lifelike, but there's no life there. It's just pure, you know, mechanical stimulus response or computational stimulus response. I think you know, it's possible to have a complex system that looks like it's living, but is really just mechanical in nature and not genuinely biological in nature.
One of the things that I appreciate about Star Trek is that even an evolved humanity has a tendency to kind of wave a hand, thumb their nose at this kind of the signs and symptoms of life. we, you know, with the Silver Blood, they, in the Voyager episode we were just talking about, they were doing these experiments. They're trying to figure out, okay, you know, what is this? And okay, it mimics life, but is it life? And they're trying to answer that question. And it took duplicate Harry Kim to help them do that. With the microbrain in the TNG episode Home Soil we were talking about earlier, this is truly one of those cases, Zachary, where, you know, the researchers that were there doing the terraforming, I mean, they didn't distinguish it to be any different than, you know, sand on a beach. And, you know, okay, it began to kind of reflect and refract light in a certain way and certain patterns, but it just had all the earmarks of being sand. And, you know, Earth is covered with sand. Why is this alien sand here on Valera 3 any different? And in fact, this silicon-based life form had declared war on the Federation because, you know, we're injuring it. We're firing weapons. And that's the way it interpreted our actions. We're firing weapons at it. So, you know, we're going to war.
You know, I think we forget here in the real world that we didn't always know as much about biology as we do
Indeed.
Now.
Indeed, and right? That was my point.
Yeah, I'm thinking like to the discovery of bacteria, right? We didn't always know that bacteria existed. There are other theories that accounted for things like contagion and spread of disease and various phenomena we associate now with microbiology. But can you imagine discovering microbiology for the first time, looking into a microscope and seeing a bacterium and going, well, what is it? Is it life or is it not life? It's not like any of the life around us, right? It's not macroscopic life. Mm-hmm. It's not a dog. It's not a cat. It's not even an insect, right? It's this tiny little thing I can barely see, and it seems to move on its own. But there's lots of things in nature that move on. The wind moves, the ocean moves. There's lots of things that just move, right? So what is it that distinguishes this as a genuine life form? And I think we forget that we've already walked this road countless times before. Every time we encounter a new phenomenon, we go, well, I don't know. It looks like it's life, but look, you know, it could be, could not be. We don't really understand it yet. As we learn a little more, we study it, we go, okay, yeah, it looks more and more and more like life. The evidence grows. And I think when you encounter the Horta or the Silver Blood or any other, you know, fringe life form in Star Trek, I think that's the progression. You go, well, it doesn't seem to match life as we know it, but let's poke and let's prod it and let's talk to it and let's try to mind meld with it and see if we can get some results. And as you do that more and more, the evidence grows and you go, well, yep, it must be alive. And now we just take for granted that bacteria are alive, but that was not obvious at all in fairly recent history.
Yeah, or let's project some resin frequencies at it and see if we can't stimulate it in some way. Zachary, we would be remiss if we didn't mention the crystalline entity when we're talking about at least silicon-based life forms. I didn't want to move on because I've got a couple of gaseous life form examples that I'm sure we'll want to touch on, but you know, kind of back into our silicon-based life forms, the famous crystalline entity from the TNG episodes Data Lore and Silicon Avatar.
I really struggle with this one, honestly, because I don't see much in the crystalline entity that really points to it being a life form. It doesn't seem to move. Yeah, it projects itself through space through some mechanism they never really explain. At warp speed, even. I'm not sure how it does that.
Lore seemed to be able to communicate with it. So that,
but it doesn't meet much of Dr. Crusher's criteria for life, does it? I guess it does consume at least energy.
It does consume energy
per se.
Yes.
Let's see. Let's look at Dr. Crusher's criteria again. Not that Dr. Crusher is the final word on this, but it's a good starting point, isn't it? Especially in universe.
Its food is basically, you know, anything else that's alive, plants, animals, soil.
Yeah, I love that her definition is in terms of plants and animals. Like, okay, her whole definition of life is what enables plants and animals, and everything else applies to plants and animals, mm-hmm. right? So the Horta is not a plant or an animal.
No.
Not strictly speaking, I guess. Not in a carbon-based sense. The crystalline entity is not a plant or an animal per se, I think. Maybe in some broad sense of animal, but not in some more narrow sense of animal. Very, very broad sense. Like, you know, it's not even carbon-based or it's not biological per se, right? It's crystalline. So So Dr. Crusher's definition is not very helpful, but let's look at the list of criteria anyway. Does it consume food? Yes, it does seem to at least consume some sort of, if not food, then energy. It derives energy from it, that's clear. Does it grow?
Yes.
I don't know. Does it?
I believe it does.
The crystalline entity is bigger in the second time we see it than the first time we see it.
Okay, that is...
It's definitely bigger than ambiguous. The child's drawing.
It's ambiguous.
Yeah, it's definitely not answered in universe. I don't think there's any reference to it being bigger. I mean, it's definitely bigger than the drawing of it. does it adapt itself to its surroundings? Yeah, I think it definitely has some, you know, possibly sentient, possibly non-sentient, you know, adaptation to surroundings. And does it reproduce? I don't think we really know that one either, right?
No, we don't know that one.
I mean, it had to come from somewhere. It didn't just spontaneously, you know, can you picture a spontaneously generating crystalline entity, like a snowflake just pops into existence out there in the universe, kind of like in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, when a sperm whale and a bowl of petunias spontaneously pops into existence in orbit of some planet, it falls to its immediate death. Do you think the crystalline entity literally just popped into existence? It didn't actually come from anywhere, so there's no reproduction involved. Probably didn't happen that way. So now I'm envisioning like the genealogical ancestral history of crystalline entities in the universe. Who were its parents?
Well, in my head...
And how exactly do crystalline entities mate?
in my head canon, I really have it related to the microbrain. I think it was the rebellious black sheep of the microbrain family.
Well, I mean, these are the questions, though. I mean, like, if you really wanted to establish that the crystalline entity is alive, I think when you first encounter it, it's a good candidate for life, right? We don't really know what it is. Mm-hmm. We have to study it. We bounce some, you know, energy off it to see how it vibrates. We try to communicate with it like Lore does. We get Dr. Marr studying it and seeing what residual energy it leaves behind in the rocks and the like. And I guess as you study it more and more, you would get answers to these questions. You could follow it around and see, well, you know, is it growing? We could measure it. We could establish whether it grows or not over time. We can see how they reproduce. And it's not always easy. I mean, you know, we encounter a new life form on this planet sometimes, and we don't know where it comes from. How does it reproduce? We don't have the answers to those questions yet, but there's enough indication of life that we give it the benefit of the doubt, and we go looking for the answers to those other questions that we don't know the answer to yet. And I guess that's what you do with a crystalline entity. You'd go, well, I don't know how it reproduces. Let's go follow it around in a starship, on, you know, maybe a cloaked starship. You know, like those little... like in those nature documentaries, you have the little robot with the camera. You'd have like a cloaked starship with a little webcam in front, like a dash cam. You know, like maybe a fake crystalline entity. Like you put a camera on a fake crystalline entity and try to mate with it.
It's like a duck blind research assignment.
Like you see like the meerkats or something, like the little robo meerkat walks up and tries to interact with the real meerkats. Can't you picture like the robo version of the crystalline entity, put a little camera on it, and it goes up and tries to like poke and prod and say hi and wave and maybe try to flirt with the real crystalline entity? They do a little dance or something, you know, kind of like the big jellyfish in Encounter at Farpoint.
Yes.
You think one of those was a undercover research robo, whatever it is?
Well, if that's the case, then the actual living jellyfish creature totally bought it. But I don't think the crystalline entity is that dumb. But unfortunately, thanks to Dr. Marr, we'll never have that chance to do that research project.
So let's talk about some other life forms in Star Trek. So we don't only, at least the Horta and the crystalline entity have the fact that they're made of matter in common, right? But we also get some really weird life forms in Star Trek. We get energy-based life forms and non-corporeal life forms. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of things like the Calamarain, or even weirder than that, like a member of the Q continuum. Q, right? He's not biological per se. He seems to be able to take biological form,
right?
But he's not biological, and yet he's sentient. He interacts. He meets a lot of these other criteria. It's not clear that he really grows. We do learn that the Q can reproduce. So again, it's one of these cases where the members of the Q continuum seem to meet some criteria for life, but not others. What do we do in that situation? I mean, it seems to be taken for granted that the Q in universe, that the Q are life forms. They're just not biological life forms. That's a pretty broad definition of life, though, if it encompasses the Q continuum.
It is. It truly is. You mentioned a Q continuum, and you mentioned the calamarine. The calamarine, as I recall, they were a gaseous life form.
So they're made of matter or energy or both.
Yeah, they're made of matter, and we encounter gaseous life forms. For instance, the companion from the original series episode Metamorphosis was a gaseous / electromagnetic life form. It was basically comprised of hydrogen gas and some type of, you know, electricity, and it manifested itself in the form of this colorful cloud. It had sentience. We know that it was female, or at least it identified as female, and, you know, it had the hots for Zefram Cochrane. And the interesting thing about that is that Captain Kirk is trying to tell the companion that it couldn't love, it couldn't live, it, you know, because it's different.
It sounds like that's as good a criterion for life as any. If something loves Zefram Cochrane, then it's probably alive.
It's probably alive.
But I don't know if we can learn a whole bunch from going down the list of different types of aliens, these non-corporeal aliens in Star Trek that are these fringe cases of life. I think each one of them raises the question anew, right? Does this fit into categories we already understand? And if not, what do we do? Do we broaden our definition of life to include it? Do we say that the definition of life is so broad that it's not just biological, not just material-based, not just carbon-based, not even just silicon-based, but energy-based or something transdimensional, where it encompasses something as so radically different from us as the Q continuum? Is that helpful for understanding life, or have we over broadened it to the point where we've lost those fine grained distinctions that matter more than the overarching definition?
Well, that's the interesting thing about these, as we're calling them, these fringe life forms in Star Trek. They do push the boundaries of what we would typically. I mean, let's give Dr. Crusher some credit. I think she, in this, you know, kind of broad definition that she has for life here, she really does define some specific criteria, I think, that we can all agree typically is going to apply to a life form. But we bring these fringe life forms into Star Trek that defy these criteria, these definitions, and they push the boundaries. Again, when you're talking about, you know, clouds and electromagnetic life forms, I'm thinking of Voyager, Haunting of Deck 12. It was a Class J nebula, as I remember. And, you know, they've picked this stray up, and, you know, they're, you know, making their merry way across the Delta Quadrant, and then all of a sudden they start having systems problems, and it's, you know, it's this Class J nebula that they've picked up into their systems. It's, you know, really upset, and you need to take me back home.
Dr. Crusher's definition is interesting because it's restrictive in some sense, but also really broad in another sense, right? She does seem to restrict it to plants and animals, but she doesn't get so restrictive as to say those plants and animals have to be carbon-based or they have to be made out of DNA, right? You could presumably have a silicon-based plant or an animal. You could have a energy-based plant or an animal, you know, animal in some really broad sense, like animal in some sense, some living thing that's not a plant. Doesn't have to be carbon even. It could be gas or it could be energy, but it's still some animal. It's animated in that sense. So, and the rest of her criteria seem to be kind of operational, right? She says if it consumes food, so you give it some food and it eats it. It's like a little miniature experiment, derives energy from it. So you can measure, like, you know, what's its digestive process, or how is it, what mechanical process does it go through to take the energy from what it ingests and does something productive with it. You can actually measure whether it grows. You can define that operationally. You can say, does it adapt itself to its surroundings? You can put it in different situations, do stimulus response, take it out of its environment, put it in a different environment, see how it adapts. Does it reproduce? You can actually observe this. So all of these things, I think, can be defined kind of experimentally or operationally. And yet her definitions are so restrictive. She says plants and animals. That sounds really narrow. There's a lot that, even in universe, there's a lot more types of life than just plants and animals, mm-hmm. right? But then you go, well, maybe she doesn't really mean those to be restrictive. Maybe she means those to be plants and animals in some really broad, inclusive sense. Animals meaning not just carbon-based animals as we know them, but animals writ large. Everything
silicon
that's animated.
Electromagnetic.
Yeah, everything that's animated inside the Star Trek universe, yeah. So maybe we're not giving Dr. Crusher enough credit. But to me, when I hear that definition, it sounds overly restrictive. But I don't know.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I tend to agree with you. It is somewhat restrictive, but...
Do you think that whoever wrote that line for Dr. Crusher knew that, you know, 20 some odd years after the fact, there'd be going to be some podcast about Star Trek and philosophy nitpicking it to death?
Probably didn't. In fact, if that writer happens to be listening to our podcast, probably is doing some eye rolling right now.
Like, that's not what I meant, guys. You missed the whole point. So I thought we'd mention just a couple of other fringe types of life forms that we see inside the Star Trek universe. And I know without a doubt, there's going to be some of you listeners out there that will call us out and point out the fact that we've missed some. I'm sure there's some obvious examples that we're overlooking. I have no doubt we own up to it. I don't have an encyclopedic memory of every life form inside the Star Trek universe, but a couple of them that came to mind were the two-dimensional life forms mm-hmm. in Star Trek The Next Generation, The Loss. And those are interesting because you might go, well, no matter what life form it is, it at least has to be three-dimensional, right? It has to take up length and width and height. I mean, even Q, when he's in corporeal form, does that, right? And all of a sudden you encounter these life forms that seem to be two-dimensional. Like, whoa, how can that be a life form if it's just two-dimensional? You know, I don't think we ever really learned what they're made of. Are they made of matter? They can't be made of matter as we know it if they're, strictly speaking, two-dimensional.
Exactly. And again, when you talk about fringe life forms, this one really pushes the boundaries. I mean, in the Star Trek universe, silicon-based life forms kind of became old hat. You know, we've been there, we've done that several times. We've pushed that boundary. And so somebody comes up with this two-dimensional life form, and yeah, it raises a whole set of other questions. Is it made of matter? Well, it couldn't be, at least as you and I would define matter. It's unique. It's different. I'm almost sad that we didn't get to explore that a little bit more in universe because it is so doggone fascinating.
I think they do an impressive amount of analysis inside the episode, right? They really chew on whether or not this counts as a life form, mm-hmm. right? You know, could they be alive? Could their movements be explained in, you know, via Newtonian physics, or, you know, maybe we can explain the fact that they're caught in the gravity well from the quantum string because space is being warped and all of space is being, you know, so maybe we could even explain that. But they try to give all these other explanations for their movements and what's going on. So it's not like they even count them as a life form from the beginning. I think Star Trek gets, I think it's seen as being kind of charitable, like, oh, when it encounters a new kind of life form, it, you know, gives it a big hug and says, oh, welcome to the family of life forms, right? That's not what's going on inside this episode. They are coming to these new life forms, these two-dimensional life forms, from a position of skepticism. They go, well, you know, we've never seen anything like this. We can't really explain it. They're two-dimensional. Can we explain them via Newtonian physics? Not really. Maybe we can explain it with general relativity, with the gravity well thing. Maybe not. And it's only when Counselor Troy kind of senses them, I sensed them, they were alive, you know, they're like the moth to the flame, or whatever she says, right? That only then do they kind of recognize it as a genuine life form. But it takes most of the episode for them to get to that point, and they don't start there. That they're not willing to extend the definition of life that quickly.
Yeah.
So the other example that came to mind are the prophets and the paw wraiths mm-hmm. in Deep Space Nine, right? They're more like Q than like biological life forms, as I understand them.
Yeah, very much akin to Q. They live outside of time. They seem to lack an understanding of corporeal existence. And so, yeah, unlike Q, they lack that understanding of corporeal existence. So in some terms, the Q continuum, it could be said that they are, to some degree, more evolved, perhaps, than the prophets of the Paw Wraiths, I think,
or at least more lifelike. They seem to be able to take corporeal form, where the prophets, they don't. Well, you know, they do seem to like possess humanoids, right? We see that with the Paw Wraiths and whatnot.
Yeah,
but we don't possession. Really see them taking corporeal form per se, like Q takes corporeal form,
right?
But again, like, what do you do with that? Are they living? Well, they don't meet a lot of the criteria for you know, they don't recognize, they don't seem to have a temporal existence. They are outside the space-time continuum. Do they eat? Do they reproduce? All these quasi-biological questions that Dr. Crusher asks. It's not obvious that they do. It's not even clear how you would measure that, so you can't even give an operational definition. At least with a lot of these life forms we've been talking about, like the crystalline entity, you can measure that and poke and prod it like Dr. Marr does. With the Horda, you can mm-hmm. mind meld with it like Spock does. And what, so Sisko seems to interact with the prophets, right? He has his visions and he has the orb experiences. So is that equivalent to some sort of operational stimulus response? Is that enough to you know, signpost them as life forms? Because in my mind, it's no more convincing than a vision on the holodeck, right? That's the extent of the experience that Captain Sisko has. He has visions and whatnot. And those are, you know, they're powerful. They're, but I'm not sure they're any more convincing from a standpoint of trying to distinguish whether they're life forms or not than an illusion on the holodeck would be.
Yeah, other than, you know, some tricorder readings, they do very little to quantify, you know, what these wormhole aliens are, what they're made up of. Just very, very little in terms of that. I mean, they found a way to communicate, so we're going to dub them life forms. And I'm okay with that in universe, but something there just doesn't satisfy.
I love that as a result of this discussion, I'm now prepared to go to a biology department at university and go, I'm going to teach you guys something about life. Your definition of life is too narrow. It has to include members of the Q continuum. Has to be broad enough to include silicon-based life forms. Has to be broad enough to include wormhole aliens and prophets. What do you think their response would be if I wandered into some random biology classroom and said that?
Well, if you need a ride after you're escorted out, just give me a call.
But I'm serious. I mean, it sounds a little crazy when you put it in those terms. And I guess that's my point. It does sound crazy because we don't generally think those things exist. But there's nothing precluding them from existing as far as we understand it. There's nothing logically inconsistent about it, right? It's not like saying 2 + 2 = 5 or anything outright, you know, illogical or inconsistent about saying that silicon could be life or other kinds of beings could meet these criteria that aren't even made of matter. So what exactly, why all the skepticism? Why would I get dragged off in a straitjacket? Like what? And I would probably say some biologists are probably more open to that than others, right? Astrobiologists who are looking for life out in outer space, even though that's not the norm for biology, is a more fruitful field than ever, right? As we discover more and more exoplanets, planets around other stars, we are looking for life in all of its forms. So you have to be open to those other forms of life. But I do suspect that if you walked into a biology classroom and said, no, this definition of life isn't cutting it because it doesn't include wormhole aliens, that you would be laughed out of the room.
Yeah, I agree. You know, when we think of, for instance, in Darmok, the electromagnetic life form that was very aggressive, that seemed to be able to move from one dimension to another, you know, that seems extremely far-fetched. When we think about the wormhole aliens, the prophets, the Pares that live outside of time, that don't inhabit a corporeal form, when we think about the Horda, when we think about the microbrain or the silver blood, these things seem bizarre almost to some people. But if anything, we should learn from the history of science that once upon a time, a round world was science fiction. Amoebas were science fiction. And in time, you know, we were able to take a theory like a round world and quantify it. And I think in time, Zachary, we just don't know what we're going to find. You're absolutely right. I mean, we have astrobiologists who are theorizing what kind of interesting life forms we might be able to find out there in the universe somewhere. And who knows, in time, perhaps we might encounter a silicon-based life form. I think it's entirely possible because, again, we science the fiction, and it's fiction now, but tomorrow, who knows?
I think you're right. This does just generally speak to the power of science and, by extension, quantification and measurement, and by extension, further extension, operational definitions, right? Trying not just to rely on intuiting definitions, but relying on things we can measure and quantify and understand that way. Because no matter what it's made of, whether it's the Q continuum, whether it's a non-corporeal being like a wormhole alien, whether it's an energy being like the being you described in Darmok, whether it's a silicon-based life form like we see in with the Horda, regardless, you can do science on those things, right? You can offer it some stimulus. You can say, let's put it in this condition. Let's present it with this kind of stimuli. Let's talk to it. Let's mind meld with it. Let's, you know, poke it with some electrodes. Let's do whatever and see what happens. And that, and whatever happens is something you can measure, you can quantify, you can write it down, you can study, you can compare and contrast, and then you're off and running and learning something about it, right? But if you just say, well, no, all of our prior experience with life is with DNA, and so if something doesn't meet the criterion of DNA, then it's not life, and that's the end of the story. You know, that if you ditch that as your starting point, you say our starting point is going to be, let's be agnostic as to what it is, and let's start measuring it and quantifying and experimenting with it and see what kind of responses we get. And then if they're lifelike, then that has just as much claim to being a life form as anything else that has those kinds of responses. And then we can make, you know, distinctions and subclasses. We can say, well, okay, life is pretty broad, and we have energy beings and non-corporeal beings and matter-based beings and energy-based beings, and we can give the different subclasses of each of those and start to talk about their essential properties. And then you've got a taxonomy and you're doing a science as we know it, right? But until you start measuring and quantifying, you can't do any of that. So I think it would be a mistake to give an overly restrictive definition of life that's not grounded in something like the empirical sciences.
Take that, Dr. Crusher.
Boom. No, not just plants and animals. It's whatever enables plants and animals and non-corporeal beings and energy beings and members of the Q continuum to reproduce and consume nutrients and grow and all the things that they do.
Zachary drops his mic and...
I just schooled Dr. Crusher. Take that, Bev. Dr. Bev. Beverly.
Dr. Beverly.
I'd like to think that Gates McFadden listens to our podcast and she will get a kick out of this. In fact, I am going to make sure that she is aware of the fact that we talked about her on this episode of Metatrex.
Yes. Gates, we...
Somehow.
Gates, we Gates love you.
We are a fan, but we are not a fan of your definition of life.
No, no. Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about the definition of life, but... this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look, everyone, at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, to the journey!
Leola is a substitute for any ingredient he doesn't have.
No sugar? Leola root!
Yeah. No bananas? Leola root!
No coffee?
Leola root!
Saturday Morning Trek.
Roddenberry was very involved with the first episode. And for that episode, we needed to come up with the derelict spaceship. And as a result, as the brand new guy on the crew who had spaceships and stuff in his portfolio, I got the job of coming up with that ship.
The 602 Club.
Yeah, well, and also that X-24... is really what he could have become. It's what he would have been if he had never escaped from Alkali in the first place, right? So it's not only facing who he had been, but what his whole existence would have been like had he not been able to break away in the first place.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, that's okay. We've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. You can also find us now on YouTube as well as Google Play Music. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include things like early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we've discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar in our MetaTreks show page on the Trek FM website, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
You can connect with us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @TrekFM.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/TrekFM, and also find us in the Babel Conference. The Babel Conference is Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group on Facebook. Just type The Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come right up. Or you can go to our website at trek.fm and click Discussion on the menu bar.
We'd also invite you to leave a rating and review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Zachary, when you're not trying to mind meld with silicon-based life forms, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek FM as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM's Voyager podcast, along with my co-hosts there, Kay Shaw and Suzanne Williamson. You can always find me in the Babel Conference if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there, and you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, @ZacharyFruling. And Mike, when you're not busy weighing the merits of competing taxonomies of life, where can people find you on the Trek FM network and around the interwebs?
Well, Zachary, on Facebook always, that's where I'm most active. You can catch me occasionally in the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also occasionally on Instagram, that is cmichael1701. If you'd like to read my blog on writing and a little bit about life, that is cmichael1701.wordpress.com. Well, Zachary, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm. He is not a bricklayer either. Executive producers Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and our Patreon manager, Brandon Shea Mutala. Zachary, we'd also like to give a special shout out to our three fabulous associate producers. They are Patrick Devlin. You can catch Patrick on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @MagicDrop5. Kay Shaw. You can connect with Kay under her Twitter handle @ChocoWeeble. And Kit Lofstad. Her Twitter handle is @MotherCat. That's mother with a zero. Well, thanks everyone for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.